I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
Episode 4, Season 1 of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by Redcon 1, Old School Labs, Six Pack Bags, and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where the subject of Season 1 is the 40th anniversary of the movie Pumping Iron. My name is John Hansen, and I'm the host of the podcast. Our guest today is a former IFBB head judge, Roger Schwab. Roger was involved in the bodybuilding scene in the 1970s. He was a good friend at that time of Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he was also a good friend of Mike Mentzer. And actually, he helped prepare Mike Mentzer for the 1980 Mr. Olympia. And he was also friends with John Balik, who went on to own Iron Man magazine. And he also wrote the contest report articles for Iron Man magazine about the Mr. Olympia each year in the late 1970s. And I would read those articles, and they were really, really exciting to read. So Roger was involved, like I said, in the bodybuilding scene in the 1970s. So we're going to talk to Roger about his years in the 1970s. He saw Arnold compete on stage in 73 and 74. And, of course, he was there in 75. So we got some great, great stories from Roger Schwab. All right, as I mentioned, we are brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon One. Redcon One believes in working hard at achieving your goals, whether it's to kill it in the gym or run a six-minute mile. Redcon One has something for those willing to put in the work. They have a pre-workout called Total War, which is a perfect companion to your workout. It's going to give you that extra push to push through your mental and physical barriers. Their premier clinically dosed pre-workout Total War is the perfect companion to your workout. It's going to give you that extra push to break through your mental and physical barriers. And then after the workout, you can fuel your body with the revolutionary MRE. It's the only whole food complete meal replacement with protein from salmon, chicken, beef, and eggs. And the carbs are from sweet potatoes and oats. And it has 10 grams of fat from MCT oil. It's the best tasting complete meal you will ever have. So go to redcon1.com and try the very best sports nutrition has to offer. Redcon 1, the highest state of readiness. And you can enter the discount code LEGENDS and get a 15% discount off your order. We're also brought to you by Old School Labs. They make uncompromisingly premium supplements. Old School Labs draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. It's the brand that I personally use to win the 2012 Masters Natural Universe and many other competitions. Old School Labs, as a favor to the show, is giving you 12% off your purchase. Just go to oldschoollabs.com and use the code LEGEND12 at checkout. And you can also purchase them at amazon.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, also I want to mention on the bodybuildinglegendshow.com website, we have a new interview up. It just went up a couple days ago with bodybuilding legend Roy Callender. Roy was a top bodybuilder in the 1970s. He actually competed back in the 1960s. He competed in the first Mr. Universe that Arnold Schwarzenegger won in 1967. So Roy was around for several decades in the bodybuilding world, and then he turned professional in the IFBB when he won the 1977 IFBB Mr. Universe. And then he had some great contests that he competed in the late 1970s and early 1980s. He was actually a part of both the controversial 1980 and 81 Olympia. So we had a really, really good conversation with Roy Callender. I think I talked to him for about an hour and a half. We got some excellent old photos in there when Roy was just starting off and then when he was competing in all his big contests. He was a really humble, thoughtful guy. I never talked to him before, so it was a really pleasure to talk to Roy Callender. It's great for me to talk to these guys because I grew up watching them compete. I was actually at the Mr. Olympia, as I mentioned before. I was at the Mr. Olympia in the late 1970s from 77 to 79. And I got to see Roy in all those contests. So to actually meet these guys, you know, decades later, it's really a thrill to me because as a bodybuilding fan, I'm still in awe of these guys. And to hear all their old stories, he had some great stories about he was good friends with Arnold and many of the other guys. So great hearing this whole history of bodybuilding from Roy Callender. So that was great. I also got some great news. I talked to Dorian Yates last week for a couple upcoming interviews we're going to have on the BodybuildingLegendsShow.com website. And Dorian was kind enough to talk to me for about an hour and a half. It was actually his wife's birthday that day. So I was really happy that he took the time to spend time with me and talk about his whole bodybuilding career. And same thing, we talked about how Dorian got started in England in the 1980s. And he really quickly rose to the top. His very first show, Dorian was telling me, people were just freaked out about how good he was. And he actually competed in the 1985 World Games, which was held, I believe, every 4 years. And it was a series of competitions that were with sports that were trying to get into the Olympics. And this is when bodybuilding was trying to get in the Olympics. So Dorian competed in that contest, which was actually won by Barry DeMay and Matt Mendenhall took second. But then we talk about his training program that really made improvements in his physique. And then, of course, he went on to compete in the Mr. Olympia contest. He did his first Mr. Olympia in 1991, which was Lee Haney's last Mr. Olympia, his seventh Mr. Olympia. And then we talk about each one of the Mr. Olympia contests that he won and how he had to overcome all those injuries. So we had really had a great conversation with Dorian Yates, and that will be coming up soon. Probably we'll have probably part one of that interview up in August in a couple more weeks. So thanks again to Dorian Yates for spending the time. I get a lot of emails from people with suggestions of what interviews I should do. People want me to talk to Robbie Robinson or Albert Beckles. So I do have Albert's number. I'm going to try and reach out to him. Talk a little bit to Mike Ashley. So we just have to figure out a time when we can sit down and talk. I talked briefly also to Tony Pearson. So I'd love to talk to Tony. Tony's still in amazing shape, 60 years old, and he's always in contest condition. He just guest posed at that 4th of July party they had at Muscle Beach, the competition, I should say, that they had out there. And he did a mixed pairs guest posing, which Tony was known for back in the 1980s when mixed pairs was popular. I think Tony was like the dominating champion in those years. He paired up, I remember once, with Tina Plackinger, and then he also paired up with Carla Dunlap, Miss Olympia, and every year he would get a different partner, and every year he would win. So Tony was really, really innovative when it came to posing. He's very artistic, and as I said, he's still in amazing condition. So I'd love to talk to Tony Pearson if he ever has the time. A lot of these guys, of course, are very busy. I know when I talked to Roy Callender, it took a couple weeks to get down to sit down and talk to him because he's very busy. He has a personal training business out in Canada where he still lives in Montreal. So, yeah, I'm going to try and get as many of these guys as I can. Some people aren't interested. I'd love to talk to Danny Padilla. I think he'd be a great interview. I'd love to talk to Tom Platz. I'd love to talk to Frank Zane. So, yeah, I'm just going to keep reaching out to these guys. I'm very persistent. And unless they tell me straight out no, like Muhammad McAway, I tried to talk to him, but he told me he's definitely not interested in an interview. So I don't know why. But if these guys are interested at all, I'm going to keep reaching out to them. And this will be a great video history of their whole bodybuilding career. So I think it's great for all of us to hear that. And hopefully it'll get more of these guys to talk to us in the future. But we do have a few more lined up for the next few months. So watch closely on the BodybuildingLegendsShow.com website. And you can sign up for our mailing list. And then you'll get weekly emails telling you what's going on in the BodybuildingLegendsShow.com website. All right, we're also brought to you by Six Pack Fitness. Six Pack Fitness creates premium, iconic meal management bags, healthy, competitor-friendly hot sauces, and accessories geared toward everyone from the serious athlete, bodybuilder, CrossFit, or fitness enthusiast. These bags are awesome if you guys want to bring your meals with you for the day or if you're going away for the weekend. They have individual compartments where you can pack all your meals, and then they've got pockets on the side where you can put your protein drinks, water, your supplements, utensils, everything you need. These are really, really awesome. I have one myself and I use it quite frequently. So go to sixpackbags.com and use the promo code LEGENDS10 and you'll get 10% off your total purchase. Every bodybuilder, every fitness athlete who is watching their diet should really have one of these six-pack bags. And finally, we're brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance out your hormone levels, which is really, really important, especially as you get older, to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been working for. They have a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but you're comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. They have very competitive pricing along with quality products and services. Those are just a few reasons to give them a call. Follow them on their website at opeshealth.org. That's opeshealth.org. Or you can give them a call at their office at 813-906-6737. Again, that's 813-906-6737. Use the promo code LEGENDS on the website, and you'll get a free consultation and 20% off any package that you order. All right, so thanks to all of those sponsors, Redcon One, Old School Labs, Florida Alternative Medicine, and Six Pack Bags for your sponsorship. We really do appreciate it. All right, let's join our interview now with Roger Schwab, one of the head judges of the IFBB in the 1980s, and we're going to talk to Roger about the golden era of bodybuilding. Here it is. All right, our guest today is Roger Schwab, and Roger was a big part of the bodybuilding scene in the 1970s. I first became aware of Roger when I was reading Iron Man magazine back in the late 1970s. Roger was the head judge at the Mr. Olympia in the early 1980s, and he always wrote a contest report about the Mr. Olympia in Iron Man magazine each year, and his reports were really detailed and very exciting to read. So I want to welcome Roger Schwab to the show. Hi, Roger.
Thank you very much, John. As I've mentioned to you, I respect your passion to stay in shape after all these years, and that you and I were both involved in what I would say was the golden era of bodybuilding. Although I got involved in the early 60s because I'm quite a bit older than you are, but my interest started way back in 1962 and in the last row of the Brooklyn Academy of Music when I watched Larry Scott win the IFBB Mr. America contest.
Wow, that had to be something.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a great history of the sport, and early on I realized if I wanted to be part of it, I didn't have the genetics to go the distance as far as bodybuilding, but I was interested enough that I decided to tackle it and go 100% in involvement in some way or another, and so I got involved. And I have no regrets as I look back, because I think the time of my involvement was the epitome of what bodybuilding was in the States and on the European continent also. So it was a highlight of my life, and I have no regrets about being involved. As far as the mid-70s are concerned, I was an acquaintance of Charles Gaines and George Butler and Wayne DeMilla, of course, in New York when the whole thought processes of pumping iron was taking place. I can also say I was one of the early acquaintances of Arnold Schwarzenegger when he moved to the United States. We had great conversations with each other, and early on, we were quite friendly. As a matter of fact, on the day of the filming of Pumping Iron, of at least the filming at Gold's Gym, I, along with John Balick and one or two other gentlemen, I don't recall right now, had breakfast at Arnold's apartment. And I remember seeing the big wooden bed that Dave Draper had made for Arnold, as a matter of fact. And then we got into this car and drove over to Gold's Gym. I happened to be in the back seat. Arnold got out of the car and walked into Gold's Gym with me behind him. If you take a look at the footage of Pumping Iron, I know you've seen it, John, because I sent it to you. But I was right behind him, and I think it was not anticipated by Arnold that Eddie Giuliani was going to run over and jump into Arnold's arms. And I can tell you that, to me, that was quintessential comradeship in the 70s as far as bodybuilding was concerned, and the peers of each other and the all-out acceptance of everybody. And it was competitive, but it was a great competition. And these guys were really friends, and they certainly looked up to Arnold Schwarzenegger. And it was a very wonderful time, especially being friends with all these guys. So it was a great time. And then the night, I think it was 1977, in a tuxedo, we all made it to the premiere of Pumping Iron. And I remember that night how happy Arnold was and how much of a hit and how much that was going to usher in the acceptance of bodybuilding into the mainstream.
Yeah, Roger, I had no idea. I know you were a big part of the bodybuilding in the late 70s, but I had no idea that you were actually in the movie Pumping Iron. And when we were talking on Facebook, you said, "Who do you think Arnold walked in with?" And then you sent me that screenshot of you and Arnold walking in the gym. So that was awesome.
And of course, it was right at the beginning also when women were getting involved in bodybuilding. It was a time of Lisa Lyon, Claudia Wilburn, Stacy Bentley, and of course, Rachel McLish. So it was wonderful times. It was the best times to me. It was the golden era.
So tell us, Roger, how did you meet Arnold? How did that happen?
In the early 70s, you know, it was very interesting. I opened up a small training facility in Philadelphia. It was a Nautilus gym. And Arnold's fiance at the time was Maria Shriver. And so Arnold introduced me to Maria, and she came and trained at the club that I owned, which was Mainline Nautilus. Mm-hmm. And a funny anecdotal thing there was that she trained hard, and she looked great, if you know Maria. And she was training on a leg extension machine in her shorts, and there was a scar coming down her, I believe it was her left knee, from mid quadriceps down to the cap, to the middle of the tibia. And I said to her, "How did you hurt yourself? How did you have the surgery?" And she said, "Football." And you kind of thought it was funny, but if you remember the Kennedys, how famous they were for playing football at Hyannisport. And of course, Maria was part of the Kennedy family. So I trained Maria, and when Arnold would come to Philadelphia, she and Arnold and myself and another woman would go out and double date. So it was a really wonderful time. Subsequently, of course, Arnold basically, when he started the Mr. Olympia contest in Columbus, had his own team. And me being from Philadelphia, I wasn't really part of that team. So our relationship didn't really continue in the same deep friendship, I believe, that we had in the early 70s, especially in the Mr. Olympia contests of 73 and 74 and going all the way up to the late 70s. And if you remember the Mr. Olympia contest in 73 and 74, John, I'm sure you will, Arnold was probably in his best shape in those two contests. And I remember at his house that morning before we went to Gold's Gym, I commented saying that I thought that he hit his potential in 1973. But I assure you that he reminded me in no uncertain terms that he was better in 1974. I don't know if you were at those contests or if you saw either one, but in retrospect, looking at the pictures, he was correct. I think he was at his zenith in 1974, although he came close to it in 1975, and that was probably his last year of great competition, excluding everything that went on in Sydney in 1980.
Roger, let's go back to 1973. How did you actually meet Arnold? Did you just go backstage and meet him after the show?
No. At the time, in 73, I was just starting to cover physique contests in Ironman, I believe. And New York wasn't, I was in Philadelphia, so it wasn't far away. And quite honestly, it was, bodybuilders were much more accessible. I would travel out to Ohio. There were contests in Ohio, I remember. And Arnold would be there. And Arnold was also friendly with George Snyder from Olympus Gym in the early and mid-70s. And again, Warrington was close to my home. And he was accessible. And he was fun. And it was very easy to meet him. This is, you have to remember, this is way before his financial situation was improved. He went to the contest. You know, he opened gyms up. He got paid certain amounts of money when a gym would open. And I saw him at a couple of openings. And we just, it was great because we could talk, and we talked outside of bodybuilding. He was, you know, he was a early young Republican, and I wasn't. But we used to like to bang ideas off of each other. And although we didn't really agree on too much, we always did it with a smile, and we were friends. And again, it was a great time. I mean, Frank Zane was younger then too, but he was appearing in contests, and you know, and it was around the time that I met Mike Mentzer also. And before that, although you're not asking, I got a chance to meet John Grimmick, who became a lifelong friend, Larry Scott and Reg Park and Steve Reeves. So, you know, I wasn't a bodybuilder. We're all bodybuilders, but I wasn't a competitive bodybuilder, but I was certainly interested enough that I made it my business to get to know these guys, you know, and to have conversations with them about bodybuilding and outside of bodybuilding. It was wonderful times, as you know.
Oh, yeah. I envy you to be around at that time and see all those guys. So tell me, what did you think of Arnold in 73 after seeing him on stage? That had to be incredible.
It was incredible. And quite frankly, he was head and shoulders above the rest, as he was in 1974 also. Although, you know, in 74, Louis Ferrigno started basically, was the second really big man, if I remember correctly. And, of course, in 73, and I think it was it 73 that Gaines and Butler in Pumping Iron went over the contest with Serge Nubre? I was at that contest in New York, and You had to see Serge Gnubre to believe it. I mean, he was spectacular, especially from the upper, in his upper body. And he was symmetrical. I mean, he, and very, very sharp. But as I think either Gaines or Butler said, you know, they're just, they turned around to the back and Arnold just surpassed him. He was just better. He was just more muscular from the back and certainly in the legs also. But it was a great, great time. And even though these guys were probably taking steroids at that early time, it wasn't craziness. And these guys had small waists and they were muscular. And they were still something that you could look up to, you know, and say, you know, I might never look like that, but it's great. You know, they were in the realm of real, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah,
and so it was great times.
Yeah. I think the line that Charles Gaines used in the book Pumping Iron was that when Gnubre turned around to hit a back pose, it was like the air went out of a souffle.
Yeah, and I think it was either Gaines or Gaines who said that. It was correct.
Yeah.
And he was a little flatter. And he wasn't oiled up as much, I don't think. And he under the lights didn't do him justice either. But if you saw Serge Gnubre in person up close, it was, you know, unforgettable physique. I happened to see Sergio Oliva. I wasn't at Essen in 1972. But I saw Sergio Oliva in Florida in 1971, and I can tell you, I don't know who was better, Arnold or Sergio, at their best, but either one could have claimed to be the best, but the other one was right behind them. And as you know, they were completely different types of physiques, but I honestly believe that they both realized their full potential. Sergio in 72 in Essen and Arnold 74 in New York.
Now, Roger, you see a lot of the physiques today, and I know the physiques are much more advanced. The guys are much, much bigger today, and they have much better leg development, and they're more ripped in the glutes, et cetera. And you were younger back then, so I know your opinion might be skewed, but watching the competitions, when you see someone like Sergio in 1971, or you saw someone like Arnold competing on stage in the 73 and 74 Olympia, and you look at these guys, what were you thinking about how they look compared to the guys today?
No comparison, John. It was there's no comparison. Even though these guys were bigger than life in the 70s, they didn't look bloated. I mean, you know, if you remember Brian Buchanan and some of the, you know, these guys, they all had small, even Arnold at 235, his waist was small and muscular. I'm a great fan of Dorian Yates, but I believe that the Yates of 1993, in my opinion, at his best, changed the field of bodybuilding. It was years of Flex Wheeler and Sean Ray, but while I supported Dorian because I respected how strong he was, the look of bodybuilding changed. You probably see it the same way because I look at your physique and, you know, I think you realized your potential and epitome, but you never lost your lean muscularity, I would say. And even as big as Arnold was and Serge Gnubre and Sergio Oliva, they weren't grotesque looking. Like I can't watch it today. I've dropped out and it and I'm not really happy about it, but I really don't think I had a choice. I didn't have a choice. When I was judging contests in Columbus, Ohio, and in New York, and when you had Menser and Robbie and Boyer Cohen, Ed Corney and Dickerson, these guys, it was just so spectacular because you watched them year after year. And I believe that it was Boyer Cohen who once said, you know, the public expects every year to see a change in us and to see us better. But as you know, as a bodybuilder, you know, to any gains that you get after a certain period of time is usually a matter of your leanness and hardness, and it's very difficult to get bigger muscles. So, but you could see the difference each year. And I mean, these guys to compete, it was just who was in the best shape that year. You could see Boyer out of shape in one contest, and if you saw him in 1980, I wasn't in Sydney, but he was spectacular. And one year he would might be off, and the next year he was really on. And you got to feel like you knew these guys. I did know them.
Yeah.
But even
yeah.
if you didn't, it felt like you knew them and you identified with them. And it was not otherworldly like it is today. That's all. And and what goes on with the shoulders in some of the today? What is in the shoulders of these people? I mean, it's not a muscle in there. I don't know what it is. It is bad. It is bad. Back then it wasn't. Back then it was wonderful. Great time.
I agree with you 100%. I mean, I've given on interviews on other podcasts, and I've been asked who I think is the best Mr. Olympia of all time. And I always think of that picture of Arnold when he's standing by the trophy with Joe Weider after he won the 1973 Mr. Olympia. To me, that's like the ultimate Mr. Olympia physique. That's the epitome. He had the muscle size, shape, definition. If you were going to define bodybuilding as the perfect male physique, Arnold in that picture looks like he had the best physique in the world.
Well, I don't think you're too far off, but I believe that if you're asking him, he would say walking up the steps in 1974 to go on stage was his best. I tell you, I reiterate to you, when I mentioned to him 1973, Arnold can give you a look, you know, when he doesn't agree with you. And I got the look, if you know what I mean. But
yeah, I agree with you. 1974 was his best shape ever. But I was just saying, when I think of the ultimate Mr. Olympia physique, I always go back to that picture of him standing next to that trophy.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree with you. I saw, I believe, that you did a previous interview with Roger Callard. And
yeah.
Callard was
yes.
around that time also. But if you take a look at his physique, he won a couple of titles. He didn't win the biggest titles, but he was muscular and lean. And if they were taking other than supplements, it really didn't look like it was grotesque. They look like, they still look like very, very strong bodybuilders. Ken Waller, even Casey Vieter in the early 70s.
Yeah.
They were great, but they were nothing like what you're seeing today.
Right.
It was just great times. It was just the era that everything positive was happening. And with women, too, in the late 70s.
All right, so let's talk about 1975, Roger. I know you talked about walking into Gold's Gym with Arnold. Did you know that Pumping Iron was being filmed when you and Arnold and John Bailiff walked in?
Yes, we knew it was being filmed, and that's as far as it goes. I didn't know who was going to be there. I didn't know we were going to see Paul Grant because he was from England, and you never knew who was going to be at Gold's Gym. But, you know,
yeah.
It was, you know, it was such a wonderful experience. And, you know, these are the guys who were always in the magazines. It was sunny California, and Arnold was the hit. You know, he was the man.
I imagine you were training at Gold's that summer when Arnold was prepping for the Olympia, right?
No. As a matter of fact, John Bailiff, I would come out to California occasionally just to visit him because we had gotten friendly when he lived back in Philadelphia. He trained Stacy Bentley, if you remember who Stacy Bentley is, one of the early female bodybuilders. And so I went out to California occasionally to visit John, and John was very close to Arnold. As a matter of fact, as you remember, that John would give the nutrition seminars that Arnold would give the training seminars to. And so I would go out there just sporadically, and we would train at Gold's Gym. How exciting it was. It was wonderful. But I wasn't a regular out there. I just happened to be there then.
Yeah, did you get to see Arnold train at all?
I got to see Arnold train on numerous occasions. What I remember most was he liked to train his upper back with a superset of Nautilus pullovers and bent over rows. And he would do set after set of that kind of work. But he always, you know, I always thought he trained hard. You know, he handled big weights. I watched Zane train with him. I watched Ken Waller. I watched Denny Gable, if you remember. All these guys, Dave Draper, Mike Katz, when he was out there, they were all like a crew. They all got along. They all trained together. And I remember the afternoons when I was out there, we'd go out to the beach. And they would lay around in, you know, in bathing suits and soak up the sun. And it was really as the magazines kind of wanted you to see, you know, the golden tans on these California bodybuilders that were just bigger than life and all the women out there. It was wonderful times. It was just, it was fun. It was fun. I'm glad I was a part of it. I can tell you an anecdotal story if you want to just hear something quickly.
Sure.
Probably not relevant, but the first time that I went out to Santa Monica, it was in the early 1970s. As a matter of fact, I was with John Bailiff, and it was a time when rollerblading was big out in the Santa Monica Pier, out in that area. And I'd just gotten out there, and it was just an hour or so since, and we walked out there, and these people were rollerblading back and forth, and I was in shorts and a T-shirt and feeling pretty good about myself in the California sun. And this girl was rollerblading towards me, and we made eye contact almost immediately that I'd just gotten out there. And as she whizzed by me, she looked at me and she said, "Work those calves." which was funny because my calf starts, you know, way up behind my knee, and I didn't, you know, who knew about genetics at the time, but it was really a cool thing. It kind of like set the stage, and you know, you're just happy to be out there.
Right.
Good times. It was very fraternity like. They were all friends.
Right. Shows you how the scene was back then. I mean, how many girls would even notice a guy's calves today?
Really? you know, you're younger, and so this was a little bit before your time, but Gold's
right.
Gym was so exciting in those periods of time. It was great, because then, you know, you would see these guys in the magazines, and then they would compete against each other. And outside of the Olympia, when they were competing, you know, the guys were competing for the America and those titles, you know, it was close. And in, you know, in the late 60s, you had Don Howarth and Chet Yorton and Frank Zane.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 70s, you know, it just kept on getting better and better, and great competitions, and the Olympias all the way up to 1980, which I recused myself because I trained Mike Mentzer before the 80 Olympia. And then I was in 1981 when all hell broke loose.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that one day. So you were at Gold's Gym, and you would see all these guys train. Well, tell us a little bit more about how they trained. You mentioned a little bit about Arnold training his upper back when he was training at Gold's. Would he train with just shorts and no shoes or anything?
You know, when I saw him train, it was in a variety of different clothing, but he would wear a strap T-shirt and shorts.
Mm-hmm.
They all would, and they would, you know, they would flex in the mirror and do their
right.
thing. And it was just like you were seeing, John, in the old muscle builder magazines. I mean, that's how they would train. You know, they would lie down and they would do dumbbell flies and they would do bench presses. And there was nothing magical about the workouts that they did. They were really,
mm-hmm.
you know, like Reg Park said to me in 1981 when we judged at the Mr. Olympia contest. And I said to him, how did you train over all these years? He said, it was all basics. He said, there was not a lot of variety in my training. I trained heavy and hard on the basic
mm-hmm.
lifts. And that's what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was out in California and watched these guys train, I mean, they did concentration curls, but the majority of their training was heavy barbell curls. You know, they did dumbbell flies. They did heavy bench presses. They did inclines. They did overhead presses. They did squats. They did leg extensions probably too fast and didn't take them as seriously as maybe they could have. The same with leg curls, but squats was their basic exercise. You very rarely saw heavy deadlifts, although Franco used to do them. And it seemed like there was a lot of upper body work, and the leg work was primarily squats. And it was a great competition on squats, by the way. I mean, some of them put a block under their heels. I remember Arnold did. The ones with longer Achilles or longer
mm-hmm.
tibia, you know, from foot to knee, you know, put blocks underneath their, you know, small weights or blocks underneath their heels and squatted. And some of the shorter guys like Franco didn't. And it was,
mm-hmm.
you know, different guys trained different ways, but I wouldn't say anybody was training overly to failure set upon set. And they, in those days in California for sure, volume was more of the thing.
Right.
But they didn't do easy sets either. It wasn't like fun time. These guys were serious. And
yeah.
they were trying to be great. They were trying to be their best. And the great thing about it is that all their peers at various times were around them training with them.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you're Arnold, if you have Ken Waller in the gym with you and Corny in the gym and Mike Katz, who was, you know, so big in the gym training, and even when the guys from Europe came, Serge Jacobs, you remember him, I think, from Belgium,
yep.
and Paul Grant, you know, who at one time, you know, his muscularity was just out of this world. You weren't going to take it easy when these guys came. You're going to train hard. And it was the atmosphere was that they're all training hard. But if you're looking for some sort of exclusive routine, you know as well as I do, there wasn't any, and they were training. It was just a lot of training, sometimes morning and night training.
Yeah.
But again, I don't know if they were putting on too much more muscle, but they were staying lean and muscular. It was a great look, and they all had it. Some,
yeah, Roger,
you know, more extremes than others.
Yeah, Roger Callard mentioned that when I talked to him. He said that they were always in shape, and then when they would get ready for shows, they would just actually put muscle on. He said they were in shape 12 weeks before the contest, and then they would put the muscle on as the show got closer, so they were never out of shape.
You're exactly right. And on the night of the contest, it was who maintained that muscularity and leanness. You know, it was always depending, as you know, John, about the judging. And even when I wrote the Iron Man, I didn't make that many friends when I critiqued the contest, you know, because you want to be honest, and you know as a writer that you, and Ricky could say the same thing, Ricky Wayne, but you weren't going to be everybody's buddy. But you gained respect if you did it right. And I remember, like, Robert Kennedy had always, you know, talked to me that, you know, he thought I was a great judge and a great writer because I always kind of told it like it was, although it wasn't always advantageous being around these guys and not telling them. But, you know, eventually they respected me. And, you know, and they would come to me after the contest and say, what did you think? And why was I placed low? And why didn't you think I was as good as last year? Or so forth and so on. And once they trust you and respect you, you know, you could say it and they'd be okay with you. Not necessarily Danny in 1981, who, if you were at the Olympian 81, Danny was the most in shape person in that contest, in my opinion, but he placed fifth, and he was not very happy about it. But yeah, you know, that's a discussion for another time, I guess.
Hey, Roger, talk about Frank Zane, because you saw him in the gym, and of course you saw him win his Mr. Olympia titles in the late 1970s. What was he like as a personality and as a bodybuilder?
You know, people like to say, you know, about Frank Zane that he was an ectomorph who just, you know, smaller than the rest, who just got into tremendous shape. But the truth of the matter was he wasn't an ectomorph. He was a mesomorph. He had broad shoulders. He had tiny waist, tiny joints. But if you took a look at his muscle bellies, especially, you know, his quads, his vastus medialis and lateralis was down to his knees. He had muscular pecs. I mean, he had a good back. He wasn't, his calves were long. He wasn't as big and heavy boned as some of the other guys. But if you take a look, which I'm sure you have, of Frank in his early days when he was a teacher in Pennsylvania, he was heavier, but he was always great. It was never like, he didn't learn to be really sharp, until, you know, the late, actually, I thought 76, which I thought he might have won the short, the lightweight, or was it short man or light man division? He lost to Franco, I believe, in Columbus. But he was very good then. But if you remember, he won the IFBB Mr. America, I believe, in 1967, the year after Yorton, or 68, the year after Howarth did. So he was good then. I mean, he was great then. The interesting thing is that you might find interesting is, in 1976, late 1976, the Whitney Museum in New York held a gala for the artistic class in New York, bodybuilding as art. Do you remember that, John?
Sure. They did that right to raise money for pumping iron.
Yeah. So I happened to be, I went there along with Ed Corney and John Balick and Arnold and met Frank Zane there. So this is late 1976, and none of them were really in shape at all. Corney maybe more so than Arnold, and Arnold way more so than Frank Zane. And Frank Zane comes to the Whitney Museum and really, really didn't look like he could have won Mr. Pennsylvania. I was shocked. And I said, oh my God, he's never going to even enter Mr. Olympia in 1977. Well, not only did he enter it and won it, but I couldn't believe it was the same guy. He was 20 pounds heavier and leaner. And, you know, that opened my eyes a little bit. Maybe that's why they called him the chemist. But it was really fun to see these guys. I mean, the New York crowd, you know, in the art industry, or the entertainment industry, who saw him, thought these guys were spectacular. But somebody like me, who had been around it for quite a while, realized they were all, you know, not nearly in shape. But how Zane changed from late 76 to 77, and then actually was better in 78, and in my opinion, realized his potential in 1979 when he beat Mensah in the Olympia. But a great guy, an intellectual guy, had an outside life, had a beautiful wife, loved to drink fine wine, and it was just a class act from the beginning to the end. You knew that he was going to talk to you intelligently. He was approachable. He had no attitude. Just a real man's man. And, you know, just a really, really good guy. And if you think about it, his professional career spanned from the late 60s or mid 60s even to the mid 80s. So, you know, he was in shape, you know, for a long period of time. was near the top of his game.
Yeah, a lot of the guys from that era, like Chris Dickerson, Boyer Coe, Albert Beckles, Frank Zane, I mean, they were competing for 30 years from 60s to 70s and into the 80s.
You're exactly right. But I'll tell you, back when we were younger, especially when I was younger, the word genetics, you know, really wasn't in the vernacular of bodybuilding. I mean, it was like if you had a short bicep, you thought, well, if you do preacher curls, I'm going to lengthen my biceps. Well, I don't know how you feel about it, but I was always taught in, you know, basic physiology that you're not going to lengthen the muscle. You can increase its cross section, but you're not going to shorten the tendon and make the muscle longer. So you would think, well, this guy, you know, has to develop his lower bicep like Larry Scott. Well, it wasn't necessarily going to happen. And you got to accept these guys for what they were, like Boyer Coe's abs. Boyer Coe in the mid 1960s, as a teenager coming out of Louisiana, he was fantastic physique, just fantastic. Right. Dennis Tenorino, same thing. I mean, these are 19-year-old guys who have more muscle than people in their 30s who have been training for 15 or 20 years. It was just the genetics. We just didn't know it then, that why these guys were so great. Casey Viator, his forearms came down to his wrists, you know. And, Larry Scott showed no visible biceps tendon, neither did Sergio Oliva. But then on the other hand, you had somebody like Albert Beckles who had a short bicep but a tremendous peak. Freddie Ortiz back in my day was the same thing. You almost had to see it. I mean, there were so many different physiques that you could block their head off and you would know the body just by looking at the body. It was tremendous days. So I don't mean to be drifting off subject, but...
No. You mentioned seeing Sergio in 1971. Was that when he was in Florida with Arthur Jones?
Yeah, exactly. And boy, was he good.
Yeah, I remember the pictures of him.
I didn't see him in Essen in 72, but I can tell you, to this day, I don't think I've ever seen a physique like Sergio displayed in Essen, Germany in 1972. He was spectacular, and I think that Arnold realized it. If that competition wasn't in Essen, I think Sergio would have won that contest. But Serge Nubre was tremendous in that contest, and Arnold was great in that contest. Boy, they were just tremendous days. But when you see Ricky Wayne wrote a book on muscle wars, and Sergio came back in the early 80s, and he probably shouldn't have come back because by that time, I think is you would know better maybe, it was his right tricep that he tore. And the legs, when you get that older, it's hard to maintain the muscularity and the size of his legs. And he just looked like a shadow to me of what he was. But if you take a look at his son today, you know where the genetics were and that family, that, you know, it's just amazing. So, yeah, but, but Sergio was just otherworldly.
Yeah, he looked super, super big in those pictures of him in DeLand, Florida.
Whose physique were you trying to emulate in those days? Or who did you look up to? And who did you find, you know, were your views the same as mine? Or were you seeing it differently?
No, I think my views are exactly the same as yours. Arnold, of course, I idolized. I mean, he was my physique idol. And I would look at pictures of him when I was a teenager and try to develop my physique exactly like his. And I think my physique kind of resembled his a little bit. I had a bigger rib cage, wide shoulders, big lats, and peak biceps.
Well, what I noticed about you and him was it seemed to me when I saw you pose that your posing routine was set a little bit like his.
Yeah, exactly.
His posing routine, you recognized, I think, and that you emulated somewhat. I think he was an influence in that area.
Well, I always thought he was a powerful poser, like when he hit the front double bicep and then he slid into that three-quarter back pose and then the side chest and all that, and all of the sweeping, majestic poses that I thought made him look amazing on stage.
Yeah, I think that you were right. I think somebody who could have really stood next to him, Robbie Robinson in the mid-1970s, was spectacular. Robbie Robinson's front double bicep, I don't think anybody matched that. Even Arnold had a slight twist to his, but Robbie was head-on, and his arms and his rib cage and his lats and his tiny waist. I mean, Brian Buchanan had a smaller waist, but didn't quite look like Robbie did. Those were great days. I don't think Robbie, every September, lost it at the Olympia. I don't think he was ever robbed. I just don't think he ever really hit his peak at exactly the right time that he wanted to do it. He certainly was an amazing competitor in the mid-70s.
I was at the Olympia also in the late 70s as a spectator.
And he was favored, and you thought he was going to win.
Yeah, exactly. In 77, he was really favored.
Especially, and I got to tell you, John, as soon as he walked out, I just knew he wasn't quite. It was disappointing because I judged him in the Night of Champions. I judged the first Night of Champions, I believe it was 77, 76 or 77. I think Robbie won, and I said, oh, boy, he's going to win Mr. Olympia, and, boy, is it going to be deserved. But he was not as sharp. He just was not. He wasn't as sharp in September as he was in May, if I remember correctly. Great contest. It was an exciting time, and you can really get excited about it because it was really the time to be there.
Roger, let's talk about that pumping iron premiere because you said you were there and you went to that in New York. I remember seeing the pictures of that in Muscle Builder magazine, I think also Muscle Mag International. But it looked like a great event. They had Robbie and Mike Mentzer, Lou Ferrigno, Mike Katz, Ed Corney. They were all posing on stage, and they had a lot of stars there. It was a cold January night, right, in New York City?
If I remember, I'm going to take your word for it, but I can tell you one thing. I had a tuxedo on, and when we walked in there, and trust me, it was not easy getting into that premiere. You had to know somebody. And I was fortunate enough to know somebody, all of them, to get in there. But I remember how happy Arnold Schwarzenegger was that night. And, in Arnold's strong, dramatic accent, and he would say, how wonderful of us that all the bodybuilders are here tonight. And he smiled, and he was happy. And of course, it was his night, and it was his movie. And it was his movie, I'll tell you. Boy, did that transform everything. Everything happened from that movie.
Yeah.
Just the way bodybuilding just moved into the limelight and became a popular thing, and it was great. It was a great time for bodybuilding.
Was that the first time you actually saw the movie, Roger, at that premiere?
Yeah, that was the first time that I saw it. I mean, I saw it subsequently many times, but that was the first time.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't see myself in it. I didn't, because if you look at it, you miss it because it was only a moment.
Yeah.
But I knew I had to be there because I was right there when you walked in, the film crew was right there with all the cameras and the guys, and Eddie Giuliani, like, he knew just what he was going to do. They knew when Arnold pulled up. They knew when we pulled up in the car outside and we walked into the place, and it was no more than 1 minute when we walked in that Eddie was jumping into Arnold's arms. And that was kind of a fun part of that movie.
What'd you think of the movie when you first saw it?
Great.
Yeah.
How could you not? It was reminiscent of the first time in 1959 when Steve Reeves played Hercules. You were too young to remember that probably. But when Steve Reeves played Hercules in the movies, it was, oh my God, it was, he was the first one. He got us all involved because there was never a muscle man who was a star, and all of a sudden Steve Reeves became the king of film. I mean, for a while he was the most popular actor, maybe not in the States, but in the world, in Europe,
Yeah, I did some research on that for an article I wrote about Steve, and they said that he was the most popular movie star in the world for like a year or two at one time.
Yeah. And, he looked great. that was different. So, you never saw anything like that. And so all of a sudden, Steve Reeves on the big screen, he was your hero. But, and so it was like pumping iron. I mean, it was another period of bodybuilding where all of a sudden it came front and center mainstream, and it was great while it lasted.
Mm-hmm.
When you saw Pumping Iron, did you ever think that it would have such an impact on so many generations of bodybuilders? I mean, it's now the 40th anniversary. It came out in 77, and people are still inspired by it. Young kids who don't know all these bodybuilders, except for probably Arnold, they watch it for the first time, and they're inspired by it. So did you ever think it would have that kind of impact when you saw it 40 years ago?
I would love to answer that question if I remembered my feelings at the time. But what I will say now is that I think one of the reasons it was popular is not just because of the bodybuilding, but it was the producers, then director of, it was Gaines and Butler who made that film work as much as it was Arnold Schwarzenegger, because they knew it was hip, and they made it hip. They made the idea of Arnold against Lou, when the real, you know, and Arnold played it to the T, and Arnold smoking a joint in the movie. They were trying to appeal to a young hip generation, and Arnold's statement that the pump was like coming. It was like they weren't just showing guys flexing their muscles. They were trying to make bodybuilding as entertainment and bodybuilding as art. And I think that they were tremendously successful doing it. They developed characters who you could really like. They created a villain, undeserved villain in Ken Waller. They deserved a loving kind of guy who was kind of a little bit lost, like Mike Katz. They developed, you know, an Ed Corney, you know, who posed like nobody else ever posed before. And then you had somebody bigger than life like Arnold Schwarzenegger defeating a relatively young kid, and they're bringing the kid's Louis' father into play, and they're creating drama, and it was very well. It was just a smart, hip movie, and that's why I think it was such a success. And you know how it does today. I don't know. You might know better than I do, but I do know that everybody who I know who saw it walked away impressed, whether they're involved in bodybuilding or not. And the fact that they chose South Africa to do it, I mean, they didn't get into the politics and all of everything, but it was lurking in the background, and it added to the drama of a apartheid Pretoria, South Africa. And it brought the weeders into play, and it brought the hierarchy into play. And you saw a lot of different aspects of bodybuilding, and it was very creative, very smart, very hip.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think both Charles Gaines and George Butler were really smart concentrating on the personalities, because back then nobody was really into working out and nobody knew anything about bodybuilding. And to the general public, bodybuilders were looked upon as freaks. So when the movie focused on the individual personalities behind the physiques, it kind of humanized the film. And I think everyone was able to relate to it, even people who never worked out in their life. Another thing, Roger, you keep mentioning over and over again in the interview is how much fun it was and how everyone really got along with each other, and they were friends and they hung out together and there was that camaraderie. A couple of years ago, there was a movie called Generation Iron, and they kept touting it as this generation's Pumping Iron. And when I saw the movie, the biggest difference I noticed between Pumping Iron and Generation Iron was that Generation Iron just really wasn't fun. You know, the top bodybuilders weren't hanging out together. They weren't having fun in the movie. It was just serious bodybuilding, and they were all individuals separated from each other. And when you watch Pumping Iron, you walked away from that movie with a smile, and it motivated you, so you wanted to go to the gym. But with Generation Iron, I just didn't get that same feeling at all.
Well, I think, although I think I described it well, I think you hit it more on the head. I think your words that it humanized bodybuilders to the people who saw that movie was really the key, because that's exactly what it did. It made these supermen into humans, and that you could actually like them, identify with them, laugh with them, have fun with them, and really get in their heads a little bit about what they were doing and how they were doing it and why they were doing it, and just the overall experience. I'd have to agree with you on that. And I think that that film, you know, really helped bodybuilding realize its potential. Unfortunately, like that I have stated in print, that I would state again, I think that first 5 milligrams of Dianabol that was distributed by SIBA, if it was going to start, it was going to reach its full potential. And I think it went to its end. And and I think that something that had showed so much promise eventually got destroyed, and understandably.
Yeah.
It was going to go the whole way. It was going to go the whole nine yards, and it did. And unfortunately, today, it's got so much past there. But, you know, Momo Benaziza died off stage. I watched Paul Dillette freeze up in the middle of a contest that he had to be carried off stage. Albert Beckles, I thought we were going to lose him in one contest. I mean, all these things happened, and it was right before our eyes. And I thought, and that, and that was when I said to myself, you know what, I guess I'm done. I guess I'm over. And then I after 1982 in Wembley, after I head judged that contest, that was that was the end of it for me, and I resigned. Still kept writing about it, but that was the end. And you know what? No regrets. I went from the early 60s to the early 80s. That was 20 years of my life viewing something sort of like the outer banks of the inner sanctum. And I think I saw it all without getting so close that I didn't get disillusioned by it. So it was great.
Well, I think you hit it on the head, too, when you said, you know, that we were talking about Arnold in 73 and 74 and how great all these guys look. Like, they still looked human. They still looked attainable, even though some of us didn't have the genetics to get to that level. You could look at these guys and be inspired and think, wow, I'm going to go to the gym and I want to look like that. Even if you never got to that level, they still looked like it was an attainable physique and it was an attractive physique.
That's right. And I, as I said to you, with all due respect, you stayed involved after all these years. You have stayed passionate after all these years. You have trained hard after all these years. You didn't let yourself go. And how many people can you say, you know, feel like they realized their potential and stayed involved with the sport and stayed passionate about it and never, you know, and never lost that passion? It didn't happen so much. I mean, I think I didn't know Flex Wheeler personally, although I watched him many times, and I think he said something to the effect that if, you know, if I wasn't training, I wouldn't go into the gym. I don't think you ever felt that way. I think going into the gym was like instant karma to you. You felt great about doing it. You probably felt greater after the workout was over, but I doubt very much that you could give up that aspect of your life. So, you know, as a rule, I would say to people, train hard and keep training all of your life and be smart about your training so you can train to, you know, an old age. I'm 72 and I feel like I've, you know, I train as hard as I did when I was in my 20s and 30s. Might not be as, you know, you get sarcopenia when you get older and you lose some muscle, but you're always fighting to maintain it. And not just aesthetically, but physiologically. So your muscles move you and support the skeleton. You want to be strong. You want to walk. You want to, you know, you want to be able to move and the ambulatory into your old age. And I think strength training and bodybuilding and is the way to get there. I always thought so, and I still believe it today.
Yeah, I do too. You look great for 72, Roger.
Thanks, John. Not like you, but I'm plugging away.
Tell me your thoughts about some of the shows from the late 70s. I mean, you were the head judge at several of the Mr. Olympia contests, and you saw Zane win his three Mr. Olympia titles.
I can only tell you that if you were in Columbus, Ohio during those shows, I can tell you that none of the bodybuilders like today have to put their hands up to their ears and wait for the audience to start clapping for them. It was like pandemonium. At these contests, everybody looked forward to the Olympia. And what was great was that the audience was sophisticated audience. And these were not audiences that knew nothing about the sport. These were audiences that knew a lot about it. And they knew all these stars. And they knew how they looked the previous year. And they knew what they expected them to look like the next year. That's why it was great. They were great, great bodybuilders. You didn't know if Roy Callender was going to be sharp in 1 year and not, and smooth the next. Johnny Fuller, you really didn't know. Boyer Coe could go look one way to completely the another way. Same with Mike Mentzer. You knew that Ed Corney was always going to be in shape. You knew Frank Zane was always going to be sharp. You saw all that close up, and it was like you knew these guys. I did because I was there and I was a judge. But even if you didn't, you know, and you were in the audience, it seemed like you were so close to these guys. You followed them in the muscle magazines. You got a chance to see them. You felt like, you know, that they were, if they weren't friends, they were acquaintances, and you really had your favorites, and you really got excited about it. It was just a very heady time to be involved in bodybuilding. It was the epitome of the sport, I would say, right in the 77, 78, and 79. And of course, you know, we've discussed, I think, not in person, but we've discussed that 1979 Mr. Olympia when it was anybody's. It was either Zane or Mentzer. And in my opinion, although I trained Mentzer for the 1980 Mr. Olympia, which I recused myself from, I think he was at his peak right when I had him in July before he went to Sydney. But if I'm wrong and taking myself out of the equation, in 1979, he was great. And when they went into the final pose down between Zayn and Meltzer, you really didn't know before they started posing who was going to win. But as soon as they started posing, I think you can take it from there, because I think we both knew as soon as that posing routine started that Zayn was going to win that contest, because he was calm and cool and knew, had been there before and knew just what he was doing. And Mike, it was just like a rookie compared to a veteran, and Zayn was the veteran. And what Zayn lacked in size, he made up for in detail, and he won that contest. And although I was much closer to Mike than I was to Frank Zane, Zane deserved that contest.
Yeah,
and Mike came up to me afterwards and said, how did I lose that? And I said, "You, in my opinion, you lost it in the posing round. You got too excited and you went too fast and you threw one pose after another, and you had a consummate professional right next to you who had been there before, done it before, and was already the reigning champion, and you lost. You didn't embarrass yourself. You look great, but you didn't win that contest."
Yeah, and what was interesting with Zayn winning 3 years in a row was that you never really knew if he was going to pull off another victory. You know, was he big enough? Was he going to get beat this time by a bigger guy? But he really improved his physique every year, from when he won in 77 to 78. And then, like you said, he hit his peak in 79.
I agree. You know, honestly, I think that he was going to improve even one more time in 1980, but he got hurt before. But if you take a look at the pictures in Sydney, he was smaller than the rest of those guys, but boy, did he had great lines. He really, really looked good. He was just lighter. And then he didn't enter in 81. In 82, which I was a head judge in 82, none of them came in great shape in 1982. It was a very disappointing Mr. Olympia in 1982. You know, Vietor was great, but Vietor, to me, looked better in 1971 than he did in 1982. That's just my opinion. Again, you know, once you got to be, if you got great early in your life, it wasn't that easy to improve every year. You could get more detail, and you could get leaner and finer, but, you know, it's quite a chore, especially as big as Casey was in 71. How much bigger is he going to get? He just had to refine where he was. But I agree with you. Zayn got better and better each year. And he did, every win that he got, he deserved.
Yeah, those were amazing contests that Jim and Arnold put on in the late 70s. They would bring these guys out, and then they would do the silhouette pose, and then all the crowd would scream their name. And I don't even think they were even posing to their own music back then, were they?
I think that they were posing to their own music. Do you think that they weren't? I'm not sure if I remember, but I remember Dickerson used to train to Frank's, train to my way, and used to bring the house down. I remember it was, you know, they were difficult years for posing routines. I remember Porter Cottrell, really a good bodybuilder, really a muscular guy. He didn't have the size of some of these guys, but, you know, you would have some of these guys posing to really dynamic music, and by the late 70s, they were getting involved in faster and faster music, and Porter came out and posed to Over the Rainbow. To me, it just didn't work. It was too slow, and I commented in print. I said, you got bad direction on that, and did I get heat for that? They didn't like that at all, and, you know, justifiably so. It was just one man's subjective opinion, but the guys like Corny and Dickerson knew just what they were doing and knew just the music to pose to, and it was tremendous. And then, you know, these guys developed their own taste in posing. But to me, and I bet you to you, the most exciting part of the contest by far is when they first walk out. You know right when they first walk out what's going on, and I remember those days. When they first walked out, you knew who was in great shape and who wasn't. And you could almost pick your winner in the first 2 minutes of them walking out on stage. There was nothing like it. You know, there was nothing like a bodybuilding contest at a high level, especially at the Olympia level, when these competitors first walk out.
Yeah, and you never knew what was going to happen. Like when Cal did that crucifix pose in 1978 after he got fifth place.
You know, I never quite understood that. You know, I had trained early in the 70s, Cal trained at a small gym in Philadelphia. He went to California, and I mean, he really, really got great in the mid-70s. And his upper body was tremendous. But his legs never really were they were good. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, Cal was great. But his upper body stood out. And he didn't win in 78. And he had, of course, you know, there was politics going on there too, because, you know,
right.
Cal was one of the main guys who wanted to form a union in the IFBB. And
right.
so I think there was bad blood then. And when he did the crucifix, I think that he had planned that whether he played second to sixth, he was going to do that. Mm-hmm. And I don't really think he wasn't as good as Zane and didn't deserve to win. So
no,
it was great theater to see it.
Right.
But
right.
but he wasn't the winner of that contest.
Well, Roger, I just want to say thank you for coming in and joining us on the podcast and talking about the memories of the pumping iron years and that golden era of bodybuilding. I hope we can have you on again, and I'd like to do another series of interviews about the 81 Olympia, because I know we were both there.
In retrospect, John, I wish I wasn't there, but I remember it like it was yesterday. And I know it was before your time, but really the early to mid-60s, when Larry Scott was king, and what was going on in the Brooklyn Academy of Music was just as exciting as the late 70s. When you, mm-hmm. if you had never seen Larry Scott in his heyday, oh my gosh, and meeting people like Chuck Sipes and George Eiferman, and I got to know these guys, and John Grimmick and Reg Park and even Steve Reeves and Lou Degney and Marvin Eater. I mean, these were early days, but boy, oh boy, was it exciting times when bodybuilding was young. It was great, great memories even way back then, and I'm glad I was alive, and I'm glad I saw it all. I think we come from the same page, and again, with all respect, I respect where you're coming from. I respect your passion. You
yeah.
write about it. You talk the talk, but you walk the walk, and I'm glad that you're in my life, and I'm glad we talk, and if there's anything I can do, you know where I am.
Absolutely, Roger. I'd love to have you back on the show again, and I'd love to hear some of your old stories about the Larry Scott days. And you're right, that was before my time, but I heard that was an amazing time in bodybuilding.
It really was. Thank you very much. Stay in touch with me, and I'm sure we'll talk.
All right, Roger. Thank you very much. Take care.
Best always, John. Take care.
You too.
All right, thanks for joining us for episode number 4, season 1 of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank Roger Schwab for a great interview. Hopefully we'll get Roger back on again to talk about some more shows that he saw. Next week, we've got a really exciting show. Charles Gaines, who was the writer of the book Pumping Iron, he also wrote the novel Stay Hungry, and he was, of course, involved with the movie Pumping Iron. He is going to be our guest. I was really excited to talk to Charles. I read both of his books many, many years ago, so it's going to be a great interview next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks again to Redcon One, Old School Labs, Florida Alternative Medicine, and Six Pack Bags for sponsoring the show. We'll see you guys next time.